How do boys learn to act like boys? Is it something that just comes naturally? Or is there a process of learning, of socialization, that leads boys to follow along with stereotypically male behavior?
Our next guest is looking to answer those questions, and she sees a big transition in the 4 to 6 year old age range as boys start to learn how to fit in with their peers.
Judy Chu joins us now. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University. Her new book is When Boys Become Boys: Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what, first of all, are the boy-like behaviors that we're talking about when we say things like boys will be boys?
I think usually parents and teachers are prompted to make that comment when boys act in ways that are rowdy or rambunctious, kind of that boy energy of being kind of frisky and out there and running around in large groups. That's usually when adults are tend to respond, mm-hmm. Look at the boys being boys.
Well, you wanted to find out where that and other behaviors come from. You followed a group of boys for 2 years, starting at age 4, and while each boy had his own personality, what were some of the common themes you saw from the beginning at age 4, at the beginning?
I think that, well, one of the more common things, it's not so much a specific behavior that they would display, although one of the things that they definitely bonded over was an expressed interest, for instance, in gunplay. Mm-hmm. And so whether or not the boys individually felt inclined to play with guns, they soon learned to say that they did like guns very much, because that was a very fast way to kind of bond with the other boys and have something in common that they could talk about and play and do their make-believe. It was more so in terms of the transition or the changes that I started to see as they, started to appear like quote-unquote boys. It was more about kind of becoming more constrained, being more careful about what they displayed. So whereas they had been very open and kind of honest, kind of wearing their hearts on their sleeves and just saying what they thought and felt in any given moment, it was more a transition towards becoming a little more strategic and a little more savvy, beginning to be more self-conscious in the sense that they were more worried about how other people might respond to them, if they were to express, for instance, an interest in dolls.
And now you talked to this group of boys over time and you tried to ask them and figure out what was leading them to change their behaviors. What kind of things did they say about why they didn't wear their heart on their sleeve anymore?
I think a lot of it was a concern about or a desire to fit in with the other boys, to connect with them in ways. They really wanted to kind of be one of the boys and with the boys. So this idea of wanting to identify as one of the boys as opposed to being one of the girls, or by default one of the girls in the class. And the other thing was just being able to relate to the other boys, to have things in common, to be able to play with them and spend time with them. And so with that goal, they were learning like what's appropriate behavior, what's desirable, and learning to align themselves with those norms that were appearing within their peer group culture and that also reflected kind of the larger norms, the broader norms in our society that our society has for boys in general.
Yeah, I was going to say it's there in the peer group, but where are these guys as a group getting these messages? Is it media, parents, everywhere? I don't know.
I think it's kind of everywhere. I mean, obviously there are some parents that, different parents have different preferences, and so some of them thought, gunplay is completely appropriate for boys this age, and they were okay with it. Other parents were very cautious and didn't really want their boys to play with guns. And so what would happen is when you get a group of kind of boys from different families with different values, the ones, who maybe aren't exposed to guns in the household, and I don't mean like real guns, but just kind of guns being okay, they would pick it up from their peers who maybe had, access to media or to messages that they weren't, that the boys weren't hearing in their own homes, if that makes sense.
And did the boys cite these things? Are they aware, I saw on TV or in this movie or my mom and dad said, do they have citations for this kind of behavior?
Well, they would talk about, like, for instance, one of the boys who was kind of the leader. He was taller. He was kind of more aggressive and more assertive. He would come in and say, you know what? I saw this rated R movie over the weekend, and there are these guys and the bad guys. They had these guns. And the other boys were, of course, kind of enthralled and kind of just like, what's going on and what is this about? And in part, even the leader, it was a little bit, the blind leading the blind, because he didn't know completely how to make sense of it. But he was kind of figuring that out by talking to his buddies about it. And what his buddies were picking up were like, oh, this is something kind know, interesting and maybe exciting. And obviously the parents, you know, or the teachers would respond in a way that made it even more interesting because they weren't really supposed to be talking about it. And so then they kind of try to hash that out. But because they're all 4 years old and don't have more information, they weren't always getting the most accurate picture of what was going on.
Are they, and this is hard maybe to see from the outside, how much are they taking this in and really internalizing it at this stage? And how much of this is posture, you know, acting, trying on what they perceive a male role to be?
I think the word that you use, posturing, is a perfect description of what's going on. A lot of times it seemed that they were learning to posture before they really understood what it was all about. And so the whole obsession or the focus on gunplay actually kind of petered out, because that was the year that the Jonesboro shootings happened in Arkansas. And when the boys saw and found out what guns could actually do, they actually became really frightened, and they abandoned their gunplay because they hadn't been thinking of it in violent terms. They had thought of it as, this is something we kind of do together. It's exciting because the teachers and parents don't appear to disapprove, but, you know, we can sneak around together and do it. But when they found out that guns actually hurt other people and could hurt children, and could, you know, they really didn't want anything to do with it after that. I mean, and so they changed to other things. They changed to sports. They changed to, you know, kind of baseball cards, things like that, other ways to bond that were kind of, that could still be, that were still kind of considered masculine ways of bonding, especially sports, you know, but without the violent edge that they had kind of been shocked by when the Jonesboro shootings happened.
How much of this, what they're trying on as masculine behavior, is really defined consciously as being not what the girls do?
Oh my gosh, so much of their masculinity, especially at that age, is defined exactly in opposition to what the girls are doing. So when they beat the boys actually created a team called the Mean Team, which they described as, you know, being created by the boys for the boys for the purpose of acting against the girls. So it was kind of a boys against the girls, but it also became very apparent that this was a way for them to define themselves in opposition to the girls. So they, when I spoke to the two boys who had began, you know, kind of created the Mean Team, they said, at first we thought it could be the nice team, but actually the girls are the nice team, so we had to be the Mean Team. So a lot of their self-concept in terms of masculinity was very much, you know, whatever the girls aren't, that's what we need to be. So defining themselves as the opposite or as being very different from girls and femininity.
And how much do the boys police each other's behavior, watch for the thing that goes outside that is too unboy-like or too girl-like?
They police each other a lot, even at this young age. I mean, the way that the Mean Team was structured, there was actually a boss of the Mean Team, who was his pseudonym was Mike. And Mike actually had the power to exclude people, because you could be fired from the Mean Team. And if you were fired from the Mean Team, by implication, you were no longer a boy, and you were by default a girl. And so there definitely were, you know, rules to be followed, rules that kept, you know, all the boys had to do this. And if you didn't do this, if you were, for instance, friends with the girls, you were at risk for being fired from the Mean Team and losing your status as a boy.
Are the boys just passively receiving messages from each other, from the world, about what it means to be a boy? Or are they pushing back sometimes, actively negotiating, trying to expand boundaries where they can?
They're absolutely active participants in their socialization. I'm really glad you brought that up, because there's definitely evidence of their resistance, a healthy resistance against both the messages that they're hearing that don't kind of mesh with what they feel about themselves or what they know about themselves, and also a resistance just against conformity. At that age, you get a lot of, you know, I don't have to do that. You can't tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. And so that definitely comes up against this wall that they're approaching that says, okay, boys have to do this. But on an individual level, they don't like to be bossed around. They don't like to be told what to do. And so seeing them kind of struggle with that and negotiate that and having to kind of reconcile, or learning how to reconcile, you know, how to be a part of the boy group, how to fit in, while also maintaining their own sense of getting to do what they want and preserving their integrity in that sense.
At the end of the 2 years, a lot of people talk about, you know, boys being less emotionally connected, worse at relationships. Where did the boys you were working with stand after that period when it came to expressing emotions and expressing relationships with one another?
That's a great question. I think that what happens is, as they become more strategic and savvy, their relational capabilities and desires, what they're able to know, what they're able to do, and the fact that they want to have meaningful connections with others becomes less apparent, because they don't wear their hearts on their sleeves anymore. They don't kind of just come out and say it. But they don't lose those capabilities. The capabilities kind of go underground. They become more difficult to detect, but they definitely persist. And I also did, prior to my study of younger boys, I studied adolescent boys, and I definitely saw evidence in their interview narratives and in my observations of them in their everyday interactions with peers and adults that those capabilities are still there. They don't disappear or get lost, but they do become less evident.
We're talking to Judy Chu. She's the author of When Boys Become Boys. In just a couple minutes, we're going to follow up on that last point and talk about what might get lost when those abilities, those emotional relationship abilities and desires are there, but intentionally suppressed. She's in her book, she makes the case that boys learn the behaviors we consider masculine around the ages 4 to 6.
And you can join the conversation. Do you see boys changing their behavior around kindergarten age, learning how to act like a boy and not like a girl, as we understand those terms to be? Do you think there are built-in natural differences in the way boys and girls behave, or do they pick up those differences along the way? You can call in now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Judy Chu, author of When Boys Become Boys: Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. In her research, she sees boys learning to fit in with their masculine social norms around age 5, and a lot of those behaviors are learned, not built in by nature.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent or a teacher? You see this happening all the time in front of you. What kind of changes do you see, say, between ages 4 and 6 in the way boys act and interact? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get your calls in just a moment. But Judy, just a few moments ago, you said, you know, boys don't lose these emotional interests, these relational interests, or even necessarily abilities, but they kind of hide them to fit in. What's the damage? What's the problem with that?
It's a difference. They basically learn that there can be a discrepancy between what they know and what they show. And what happens then is when they show less of what they know, people can underestimate what they know because they say, oh, well, boys can't do this, or they're not interested in, you know, they're out of tune or just not interested in relationships, out of touch with their own emotions, and they get definitely underestimated, and their relational capabilities go unacknowledged, at least in the literature on boys and also in their everyday lives. And that can be, you know, to boys' disadvantage, because people then treat them as though they don't know these things or they don't want these things. And then they can, you know, it just creates a cycle where they learn that, oh, well, this isn't something that I can share with other people, when those connections are something that they continue to seek throughout their lives. I mean, just kind of connections in which they can feel truly known and accepted. Unless they're able to share themselves with at least a select few, they can feel very lonely, and that can be very difficult, especially as they continue through adolescence and into adulthood.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jack on the line in Kenosha. Jack, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for a good show. I'd like to ask the guest if she's familiar with the research done by the Discovery Channel and Discovery Magazine. They've been doing it for decades. One of the things that they found is that in boys and girls, the degree of masculinity or femininity in either sex is really determined pretty much in utero, and it's determined by different things, but oftentimes by chemicals that are used by the mother, and they determine, you know, whether, for instance, a young boy, I have a friend of mine, her young son was very quiet, very gentle, loved to read and fish, as opposed to, I knew a lady who had a little boy who had 3 or 4. She literally had to keep on a leash. This kid was the ever-ready bunny. He'd fallen out of the second floor and just kept on going. You have these extremes. And my comment about this is, until we begin to understand that and honor that, as well as honoring differences in sexual orientation, et cetera, we're really doing harm to people to expect people to all be the same and to fit into, you know, one nice square little box.
Jack, thank you so much. That brings up a lot of issues. Judy, where do you want to run with that?
I'm so glad you brought up that point, because I think it's a fantastic point, and I agree entirely. I mean, that definitely there are more individual differences than between group differences, and so that's one of the things that people tend to not consider when they talk about, oh, boys do this and girls do that. Well, the differences among individual boys, as Jack pointed out in his examples, can oftentimes be greater than the difference between the average boy and the average girl. And so it really doesn't make sense to kind of pigeonhole people based on their sex or gender, because there can be a lot of other things that contribute aside from, you know, their mere sex or gender, their backgrounds, their family backgrounds, and their communities, and their race and ethnicity, and all those things can contribute, or even their individual temperaments and personalities definitely can shape more who they are than their simple category of sex or gender.
And Judy, you write that your own son was that quieter kid who didn't want to do the boisterous, rowdy boy stuff. How difficult is that situation, that kindergarten era, for somebody who doesn't want to do the traditional or stereotypically whatever boy stuff?
Right. My son was tended to be shy and quieter and didn't want to run around with, you know, he said that, you know, the other boys play a little rough and he'd rather just sit out. And actually at the school that he was at the time, unfortunately, they found that shyness and sensitivity in boys was a problem. And they would meet with us and tell us, you know, how problematic this was and that we needed to help him change and help him to kind of come out of his shell. And luckily, because I had done this work, I felt a little more confident staying with the idea that this was okay and just to let him write it out. And these days, he's, you know, a little less shy. He's still very sensitive, but he definitely enjoys being with his peers. And he just kind of needed to come out on his own schedule and not when people wanted him to be rowdy and rambunctious at that time. And so just kind of respecting each of our boys' own, again, like Jack pointed out, like their own personalities and temperament, and trying to meet them where they are and then helping them to move ahead and develop in the ways that will foster their own strengths, their individual strengths, and help them to kind of, you know, come into themselves in the ways that they feel comfortable.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Eva in Algonquin, Illinois. Eva, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up that, you know, in the earlier years when the kids have structure and then they go with their siblings, and that seems to be easier just from what I've experienced. And I work with pediatrics, so I find that with the adolescents, the trouble comes in with the bullies. Mm. It seems that when the boys are being bullied later on in life, or depending on their circumstances, it seems that they become more aggressive and more depressed.
Eva, thanks a lot for the call. Sounds like you were starting to break up a little there. Bullying, Judy, are you seeing that as early as 4 to 6?
Unfortunately, that does seem to be coming in at early ages these days. I know that the school my son was at, they had a big bullying problem in the first grade, which feels early as a parent, but definitely was coming in with the taunting and just kind of this one-upping competitive environment that the boys create for themselves because they feel compelled to have to prove themselves to their peers. And it's definitely a problem, and as Eva was starting to mention, it can lead to at least, you know, either aggression or have kind of feigned aggression and depression when they're feeling like they can't connect with other people and that their environments aren't safe.
Is bullying a big part of the story we're telling here? The bullies themselves are trying to display what they perceive as appropriate male behavior, and the people being bullied are those who don't conform to that?
I think that it's complicated. I think that in my book, Mike, who was the leader of the mean team and would oftentimes definitely appeared to be the bully. He would order other people around, boss other people around, and definitely had more aggressive tendencies. But if you look at his case study, you also understood that in many ways he felt very vulnerable. He was very vulnerable and scared of being abandoned, and that was why he had kind of wanted to create this team in the first place, so that he could punish anyone who wanted to try to leave him. And so I think each of the boys is trying to strive towards an image that they think will protect them and help to ensure the relationships that they want. They're trying to stay connected both to other people and to themselves. And in the way that their socialization is set up, you know, kind of emphasizing these masculine norms that emphasize physical toughness and emotional stoicism and self-sufficiency as the pathways to success, those are not serving them well in their quest to kind of have these relationships in which they feel known and accepted.
Well, looking at the research you did and the research that's out there, what kind of lessons can we start to draw for parents and teachers?
I think that in general, I usually suggest to parents and teachers who are looking to support boys, first of all, to acknowledge boys' relational capabilities as something that's healthy for boys, that's something that's going to be, you know, conducive to their overall health and also their success in terms of feeling connected to other people, feeling whole in themselves, getting to know themselves and feel validated in that sense, but also not necessarily pushing any one behavior or another. So my suggestion is not that we replace the traditional masculinity list with some other list that we decide for now is more valuable or better. Like, when we don't want to change, you know, replace the masculine, you know, the macho man with a sensitive man, but more so with an emphasis on fostering boys' awareness, their self-awareness, their conscientiousness, and there's critical self-reflection, so that sometimes if they hear messages that aren't consistent with what they know to be true of themselves or of their relationships, that they're able to kind of say, this doesn't sound quite right to me, and I feel confident enough to not feel compelled to kind of conform to these expectations that don't fit me correctly, that feel uncomfortable for me. So helping boys to stay in their comfort zones and therefore be, you know, quote unquote, true to themselves, and to find relationships that will support those efforts.
Is it fair to say maybe look toward, whether you're raising boys or girls, look for human qualities to promote rather than worrying about the male or female qualities?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And just to kind of, I think there's, Terry Real said that, you know, when we take the whole range of human qualities and we divide them into masculine and feminine, and we say that only boys should be quote-unquote masculine and only girls should be quote-unquote feminine, that everyone loses, because actually a lot of these qualities are human strengths, are things that will serve everyone well. And so if you can help them to be true to themselves, whatever that may be, and there will be, and to also account for individual differences, the fact that everybody does have different, you know, some people are more outgoing, some people are more shy, some people are more gregarious, and to kind of really figure out what each person's strengths are and help them to develop those in what ways you can, that's how we can better support our kids.
Judy, thanks for joining us today.
Of course, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Judy Chu. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University and author of When Boys Become Boys, Development, Relations, and Masculinity. If you have some more thoughts on this conversation, share them over at the Central Time Facebook page.